Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Jonathan came into the world at 7:27 a.m. on May the 22nd, 1983. What I remember most was when they held that beautiful baby in the air for me to see. And from that moment forward, he was the center of my universe. He was a healthy baby, a happy baby. He slept through his first night at 11 days old. Everything was smiles for him. I know that some babies wake up cranky. Not Jonathan. Jonathan would never wake up cranky, ever. He'd always wake up with a smile on his face. He was rarely sick. His confidence, Jonathan, from the time he was small, he had this confidence in himself. And it just would, there were so many times it would just radiate from him. And even if he ended up getting hurt, you know, doing something that, ended up hurting him, I remember when he fell down a hill and ended up, he couldn't even get his hands out in front of him, and he fell down this hill and ended up getting a great big scab down the side of his face. But he was okay with that. It didn't scare him. He was never one to back down from anything. He was just always ready to go. When Jonathan was in third grade, we moved from Fullerton to Corona. And Jonathan quickly got the lay of the land there. It was nice because it was there at the base of the foothills and a lot of open space. Very nice area for a young boy. You know, thinking about that, when we moved, initially Jonathan wasn't very happy about it. That's true. A move is always hard on a child, no matter what. It's change. But he quickly adjusted because he quickly realized that he had a lot more area to explore. That's the thing about Jonathan is he would never look at the bad side for very long. Even if it was something that he didn't like, he wouldn't focus on the bad. Oh, and when it came to his daddy, as a little one, whenever his daddy was in the room, he'd just light up. But he didn't want to help his dad with everything. But oh my goodness, he loved to follow his dad around. His dad would do all the work around the house, and he'd follow around, and he'd say, "Me do it, me do it." They just would share so many laughs and so many smiles, and there was such trust there for Jonathan to his father. When Jonathan came home from school every day, he came home to his dad. And the very first thing they would do is they would go out and they would saddle up the horses. And they'd ride up there into those hills. Behind us, there were orchards full of orange groves and avocado groves. And they would ride through those and they would pick oranges off the tree. And they would ride up into Cleveland National Forest there, and they'd find themselves a plateau. And they would sit on their horses and they would peel their oranges and look down over the valley and solve all the problems of the world. And the two of them referred to that as their quality time. Initially, when we first moved to Corona, the Christmases would be crowded. Everybody would come over. But as the years passed, a lot of people, you know, the traffic got heavier, and to try to make that drive. Christmas is very different now.
My name is Jane Bright. I'm mother of Evan Ashcraft. Very proud of my son. He was born May 22nd, 1979, at 12:25 in the afternoon, and he was killed in action in Al-Had, Iraq, on July 24th, 2003, at 2:30 in the morning.
I can't tell you how proud I was, how blessed I felt when I had him. I could not imagine that I had this incredible baby. He was such a gift. Very early on, he was very affectionate. He would put his face up to my face so that I could kiss him along the side. And that was our thing. I was extremely close to Evan. He told me things that I'm sure he never told other people, and I believe that was formed the first day. When I had him, as soon as I got back to the maternity ward, I took him out, I laid him on the bed, I took off all of his clothes, I checked his nails, I checked his toes, I checked his fingers, I checked his ears. I mean, and that's when I said, you love them when they're in your womb, but I fell in love with him that moment, and you do fall in love with your children to the point where you cannot live without them.
My name is Jim Bright. I'm Evan's stepfather, and I came into Evan's life when he was about 12, 13 years old. Initially, it was a very tenuous kind of relationship while we both tried to understand each other, but over a period of time, that relationship changed from being tenuous to being a very deep and a wonderful relationship as we both began to care for each other.
And is he your only son, Jane?
Evan is my older son. I have another child, Drew, who's 21, whose birthday is September 22nd, 1985. My boys were and are extremely close, very loving brothers. They fought a lot, argued a lot, were extremely close. And when we lost Evan, I can still hear Drew's words. What am I going to do? I've lost my best friend. What am I going to do? I've lost my best friend. They were literally inseparable.
Did Evan automatically take a protective role over Drew?
Absolutely. I have a picture. I want to say Drew was maybe a day or two old. And this is so sweet. He's holding Drew and looking down at him and talking to him the way I used to do to him. He was so nurturing to Drew that in so many respects, I think that he was more than a big brother. Drew was this pesky little brother on top of Evan just adored him. He was a couple of days after I had Drew, I had Drew on a Tuesday, and on that Friday I took him to Evan's classroom to share him. So he was 4 days old. Evan takes him out of my arms and walks around the classroom and said, "This is my baby. This is my baby." He was Evan's little brother, and it was always that way.
The military service became an attraction because his mother's family came from military service. I was in military service. His father was in military service, and so it began to create a structure for him that was attractive.
So it was understood that in our family, military service was no more than that. And I know that Evan did not expect to go, quote, to war. He said to me in phone calls before he deployed to Kuwait in March of 2003 that if he'd known there was going to be a war, he wouldn't have enlisted. And I said, yeah, I know. I understand. And so he went to Kuwait in March of 2003. And was killed 4 months later.
And when after he joined, I spoke to him a number of times while he was in boot camp. He advanced very rapidly in the military. He was a natural leader. People gravitated to him almost automatically. And so he moved from being a simple enlistee. Well, he moved from being what they call a grunt, for lack of better terminology, became a team leader. They recognized that he had leadership qualities.
Most of his comrades in arms, I guess, found him to be exactly that, found him to be someone that they could go to for acceptance and for advice and to lead by example, and that's exactly what he did.
In his unit, I believe that the other soldiers looked up to him because he was self-possessed. He knew who he was. He knew what he was about, and I think some of the soldiers who may have been less confident looked to him for stability. He cared about people. He cared about what he did. He loved his job. He loved being in the Army. But I think that the whole idea of going to war and going into combat was not what he had anticipated. And I think that that's probably true of so many of our soldiers.
I had a C-section, so I was in the hospital for extra days. I thought the 5 years... Well, actually, when I planned the 5 years was because I figured, well, one would be out of college and then the next one would be DF. But it didn't work that way.
What was it like bringing him home from the hospital?
Scary. I was scared. I read all the books, but it's not the same. You know, it's no instruction manual. You know, you're afraid you're going to drop him, or I couldn't sleep at night. I kept, you know, checking the bassinet, make sure he was still breathing. It's an experience. Wait till you have one. So, this is in grammar school. Derek had some issues with one of his teachers. And anyways, the teacher left the classroom for a few minutes to talk to the teacher in the classroom next door. And this is towards the end of the day, but regardless, they were still in session. Derek stood up and announced that the class had been dismissed. So half the kids left, and of course he got in trouble. Another time, the same teacher, Derek started a petition to dismiss the teacher. And of course a lot of kids signed it, and Derek got in trouble again. So he was kind of constantly doing things. I mean, it depends on how you look at it. You could say that he had leadership skills, but you know, it was just that. I think he was good with people. And it was easy for him to make friends of all ages. He had friends in the neighborhood that were older, and whenever he'd, especially after he moved out, moved in with his dad when he'd come out, he'd, you know, visit them. And there was a gentleman that lived down the street. His name was A.B., and he was in the military. Anyways, he passed away, and my son wore, you know, his Marine Corps uniform and attended the funeral and actually presented the flag to his wife. So, and he'd always keep in touch with people, not visit.
Did he have any complaints when he went over to Iraq?
So, He was bored.
Doesn't change anything. But he died doing what he wanted to do. He wasn't drafted. He chose to become a Marine, and he chose to follow orders. He had written that he would rather die. No, I need to find that because I don't know. I wrote, my greatest fear is boredom. I could get blown away somewhere in the world, and that would be better than to die in a nursing home. There's no greater contest than combat. The stakes are your life, after all.
Did you notice a big change in personality after you went through boot camp?
Oh, definitely. It's just he wasn't afraid of anything. Of course, he was pretty fearless before he went in. He was more confident in himself. A couple of times I met him on base, since I'm so close. I remember I was waiting for him. I was trying to get a hold of him, and I'm just kind of standing in the parking lot looking around, and then I saw this Marine walking towards me, and thinking, oh, that's a good-looking Marine, you know. Oh my gosh, that's my son. I didn't recognize him. He was a different person in uniform.
So he was tall.
Well, he was taller than me. He's actually, this was actually was a poster that they brought back from Iraq. This is a poster they had of when they had his service in Iraq. He loved the ocean, and he used to body surf. We took him to Club Med Eleuthera in the Bahamas.
Did he really like to travel with you?
Yeah, he loved traveling with the... He was 3 when we took him on the first trip.
How did Eric take this?
What was hard for him was that he was kind of in the background the whole time. The whole focus was on Derek, on Ken, and me.
Do you and Eric talk about Derek?
We talk about him when we remember, you know, things that he used to do with... Things that they did together, like when we were in Costa Rica, I was taking a shower and the 2 kids were supposedly watching TV, and then I hear a door slam. I'm thinking, oh great, Eric's been teasing Derek. So Eric ran out of the room, Derek ran after him, and they ran through the whole complex, and Eric ran around the pool, and then Derek jumped into the pool with all his clothes on to catch Eric on the other side. Of course, he couldn't swim fast enough because Eric's really fast. But, you know, we'll talk about things like that. And Eric will say, Mom, do you remember when... I said, yes, you drove me crazy on that vacation. I said, it wasn't a vacation. It was a test of my patience the whole time. There was an incident that I had with... They were upset because they said I had contacted the media when this happened, and the reason I had contacted them is because the story that they were telling that evening was incorrect. I don't remember exactly what, but I called them and said, no, it's, you know, one of the Marines, it's my son, you know, so basically told them that, and then that's when they said, well, can we come out and interview? And I knew it was because they're afraid of what I was going to say, but as far as I was concerned, it was to honor my son. It's not to make any political statements. So.
What did the award say about the reason?
Basically, because he was killed in combat.
Wow.
Yeah.
For his 17th birthday, his dad went out and bought him an F-150 pickup truck. And so, just like his dad, he picked out a white one. And so people would drive by our house and they would see Jonathan's F-150, my F-250, and his dad's F-350. And they were all white. And I tell people, yeah, that's daddy truck, mommy truck, and baby truck. We're a truck family. When he was a junior in high school, he was doing some work out in the barn, and he dropped a 500-pound bin on the tip of his big toe. And he came limping into the house, and he was walking on the heel of his foot, and he told me, he says, "Oh, Mom," he says, and he was just grinding his teeth. He says, "Oh, Mom," he says, "I think I really effed it up this time." And we went down, and sure enough, he had cut off the tip of his big toe right from the base of his toenail. And they had to sew his toe back on. But not a tear. And this is something that later on came back as not necessarily being a good thing, because with Jonathan, the more pain he was in, the quieter he got. He would grind his teeth and he would just bear it. He was a 2001 graduate. Jonathan graduated from the high school that I now teach at. And in 2001, as I watched him walk across that platform and accept his diploma, I thought he had his whole future ahead of him. And I was so happy for him and so proud. And at that point, I didn't figure that I was going to cry over anything he did, you know. And he got to the front of that stage. And before he walked off the stage, he stopped and he blessed himself. Actually, he signed up when he was 17. His father and I went down to the recruiting station and signed his papers with him, even though we had tried to convince him that he shouldn't do this, that he had many other options. And we wanted him to go to college. And he says, "Don't worry about it, Mom. I'll get there." I said, but son, you know, just pick whatever college and you know, your dad and I will pay for it. Stick it to it. Go ahead. That's what we're here for." He said, "You don't understand, Mom. I don't want you and Pops to pay for my college." He says, I'm going to do this. He says, "I'm going to sign for 3 years, and I'll get the GI Bill, and I'll pay for my own college." And so, in August of 2001, he went to boot camp. After a number of weeks, though, he pushed himself so hard that he woke up in the hospital. He had developed a pneumonia that was so severe that he had ended up passing out. And like I said, he woke up in the hospital with IVs attached. And that was September the 11th, 2001. It kind of changed things. Jonathan had enlisted in the Army pre-9/11. But after 9/11, the whole aspect of being in the military changed. There was a lot of things about the military that he didn't like, but there was many things that he did. What 18-year-old boy wouldn't find being paid to blow things up simply thrilling? He was very good with C4, and he sent me a picture of himself holding a block of C4 as he crimped off the detonation cord with his teeth. And if you look really close at that picture, I think you can see a twinkle in his eye. He had decided to get out of the military. He had signed for 3 years. His 3 years were up. He was supposed to have been out in July of 2004. But they put him on this thing that's called stop loss. And they sent him to Iraq in October of 2004. Not only did they put Jonathan on stop loss to send him to Iraq, Jonathan was basically non-deployable physically. When they were doing their training in Kentucky, they had ran over his ankle with this Striker vehicle that he was training on. That's 18 tons. And they ran over his ankle with an 18-ton vehicle. And when he was going through the process of what they call ETSing, or getting out of the military, they do an exit physical. And when they took weight-bearing x-rays of his foot, the doctor that was looking at that x-ray, Jonathan tells me, he goes, "Mom, I was standing there," and this doctor looks at the x-rays, and he looks back at me, and he looks at the x-rays, and he looks back at me, and he says, "You walk on this thing?" And he says, "Yeah, roger that, sir." He says, "You must be in excruciating pain." He says, "Yeah, roger that, sir." I told you Jonathan had a high pain threshold. The more pain he was in, the quieter he got. And this doctor told him, "Son, you got to sit down. I got something to tell you." He says, "Yes, sir." He says, "Your foot's fucked up." He says, "Okay. What are you going to do to fix it?" He says, "Well, you need surgery. All of the tendons in the arch of your foot have been severed, and your toes don't know what to do to keep you balanced." He says, "Oh, that explains why I faceplant." He says, "But they've got you up for deployment, and they're not going to do this surgery. They'll probably put you on steroids, but that won't do you any good. Probably more harm than good." So no, they didn't do the surgery. The next week, he was sent to Iraq, and he was stationed at FOB Marez in Mosul. I had thought I was paying fairly close attention to what was happening in Iraq. And one of the things that I had been unaware of was that Mosul was the town in which they killed Uday and Qusay, Saddam Hussein's sons. And that's where my boy went.
Evan started music lessons. He wanted to play guitar, and he had been talking about it from the time he was about 5 or 6. And we thought, you know, he was very smart. We knew he would have no problem learning how to read music. So we said, "Well, why don't you take piano lessons, and then when you are ready to move into other instruments, you can." So when he was about 7, he started taking piano. I had my grandmother's piano.
He was not in a band, although if he, I think, had developed his musical interests, he would have. What he wanted to do at that point was be a disc jockey.
In his bedroom, he had guitars, he had keyboards. We had the piano in the living room. I mean, music was always his life. And he said to me one time on the phone, right before he deployed for Iraq, we talked probably two or three times a day. And it was just him and me. It was just us talking. We didn't have other family members on the phone. And he said, "Mom, music is my passion." And I said, "Well, when you come home, do music. Do what makes you feel good. Do what makes you happy." And I think that's probably the direction he would have gone in. He tested out of high school when he was 15. And so he thought that meant that he didn't have to stay in school. And we said, no, you have to go to school. You can't just be out on the street. But I think that school held no allure for Evan because it was always so easy. And I think that was part of the quandary. There was no challenge for him. I felt that he could have finished college and at least undergraduate in probably 3 years. And we tried to talk him out of going into the Army. I said, you don't have to go into the Army for the education benefits. We can afford to pay for it. I don't know what I want to study. Well, what about music? Well, I don't know more. He didn't know. He and Ashley eloped in May of 2000, so he was 20.
Was he already in the Army when he eloped?
Yeah, they'd been together. She was 16 and he was 17 when they met. They had their 10-year plan. He was killed in July of 2003. He was supposed to get out in September. And he was going to go to school. And that's when we were talking about, before he deployed, what he was going to do when he got out. And he said, "Mom, I want to go into music." And I said, "Do it. We support you in anything you do." And they were going to start their family after that.
So, yeah, I think that he would eventually have done one of a number of things. Been in a band, done recording, been a DJ, been a composer. If he had come back from Iraq, I think that's probably one of the most important things he would have pursued.
So that was their 10-year plan, and they were into about year four and a half of the 10-year plan. Can you imagine being 23 and a widow? Ashley was a huge part of his life in terms of her drive and her energy was so important. The last time I saw him alive was January 5th, 2003, and we had all gathered out at Ashley's parents' house for a final breakfast, and I kissed him and I held him close. And I didn't have any sense at that moment that anything was going to happen. Evan was killed by a direct hit from an RPG, rocket-propelled grenade, and he was driving a canvas-sided Humvee. And so the whole left side of his body was quite terribly damaged. They did a wonderful job putting him back together. But you could see the stitch marks back on the side of his head. And I said, if they see this, it's just going to make it worse for them, the stitching. And so I moved a plant on a pedestal far enough, and it stayed there. So only Jim and I were the only ones who saw exactly the nature of the damage. But I did get to kiss him goodbye. The day of his funeral, people left, and I stood there and I touched his coffin. It's all you can do. And so this is our new reality. This is my new reality.
They say that the impact of this war on families and friends and military are going to create dislocations and anguish and pain for decades to come. There's no question about that because it's already happening. It's so sad. Not only the loss of people who were in the war, both for Americans and Iraqis. It's just sad, and I wish it never happened.
Jim was the one who got the foundation going. It gave us a purpose. that allowed Evan to live on?
Within a month after his death, Jane and I said, we need to do something to fulfill his wishes to help people. So we created a scholarship fund that eventually morphed into what is now the Evan Ashcraft Memorial Foundation.
One of the reasons, I had a very selfish reason for wanting to start the foundation, and it had to do with my son not being just a Department of Defense number. I didn't want my son to be just a statistic. And then we soon came to realize that there was more had to be done than memorializing Evan. What had to be done was we had to help take care of those who were coming home. And so over time, our foundation has evolved, and now it's about the living. And I actually believe that, I mean, I feel that Evan is with me in spirit, and I feel that if he could sit here and talk to me, he'd say, Mom, but that's the way I always wanted it to be. I always wanted it to be about the living. I never wanted it to be about just me.
I'm hoping, and I'm expecting, and I'm certain that what good we do in Evan's name is something that will perpetuate the kinds of things he wanted to do.
The phone conversations initially at the early part were similar, although he had difficulty getting time to talk to us on the phone. However, as time progressed, there were indications that he was having difficulty.
Logistically, the provisions had not caught up with them. So he was drinking tainted water. He didn't have enough food to eat. He said he only lost about 25 pounds to dysentery, but looking at his pictures, you can see, you know, he was a big guy. He was about 6'1", 200 pounds when he deployed. And he looked like a shell of his former self. Deep circles around his eyes. He had what they call the thousand-yard stare. So the post-traumatic stress disorder, the PTSD, had already begun to set in. And he looked dreadful. And, you know, I looked at those pictures, and I could not believe that that was my son, because I can't believe what it was like for him. He had to trade his socks for food because he didn't have enough food. And he drank tainted water that, you know, these companies that we contract with were supposed to be giving them water. The FRC, the bases have what they call family resource coordinators, and the FRC at his base had emailed all the parents and said, tell your soldier that if they want a hot meal, they're going to have to sleep on the ground. Okay, so these are guys doing 20 hours at a time, and they can't even get a freaking bed, or if they want a bed, they can't have a meal. So he was trading his socks for food.
He made a simple statement one time to his mother and I. He said, I've seen a lot of things, terrible, terrible things. When I come home, all I want to do is help people. It was a very simple statement, but it reflected what he had experienced in the war, which I can only imagine were horrible.
Jonathan was an amazing storyteller. He would tell you a story, and you would think that you were like watching a movie play out in front of you. I remember when he had told me, he was all excited. He says, Mom, he says, you know, the military and the Army, they pay you $100 a month extra for every language that you test fluent in. Can't wait to take the test in Spanish. I said, but son, I said, you got to understand, they're going to probably throw a lot of these other accents at you, you know, someone from, you know, Nicaragua or Guatemala or Cuba or Colombia. He says, no, that's okay, Mom. He says, I'm going to go take that test. And he did. He took the test, and I had to push him on telling me about it because he was a little bit bummed out about how it went. And he says, "Yeah, Mom, I took the test." He says, "And I came out all bummed out because they only labeled me 50% fluent in Spanish." And he says, "So I was all bummed about that." He says, "But then I got to thinking, $50 is $50. I tell you, he never focused on the negative. And so he was happy with that. And he says, "Plus, Mom," he says, I had to understand, you know, one of my other friends went to take this test the same day I did, and he came out too, and he was worse than I was. He was really down in the dumps. And I asked him, I says, you know, what's the problem? He says, "Doggone it, they labeled me 50% fluent." And they were talking and comparing notes, and it ended up that they had ended up, you know, at the same score, missing about the same things. And so he tries to perk this guy up and look at it the way he was looking at it. Well, $50 is $50. The other guy says to him, he says, "I understand that. But what language do they think I'm fluent in? I just started speaking English 2 years ago." So Jonathan just put his arm around his shoulder and says, "Hell, it's the Army." He was in Iraq for 10 weeks. And at 8 o'clock in the morning, I picked up the phone and heard, "Hey, what's up?" And I knew that was my boy. And so at that moment, I was probably the happiest person in the world. But there was something. There was something different in his voice this time. And the more I listened to him talk and tell me about things, I realized, and I said, "Jonathan, you sound exhausted." And he says, "Yeah, Mom." He says, 18, 20 hours a day, 7 days a week. He says, "Yeah, I'm toast." He says, "But I wanted to call and let you and Dad know that I'm okay. And I love you." And he says, "Mom, I just want you to remember, I have no intention of dying in a foreign country. Eighteen hours later, a suicide bomber was allowed into his mess tent on his military base. And that suicide bomber succeeded in killing 22 people that day. 14 of them were our military men. One of them was my only child. You gotta understand, as a military family, you always pay attention when there's been a fatality. Because you know that they must notify you, or they try to notify you within 24 hours. So as the day went by, and the body count went up, and no one came to my door, I was relieved. It's a very bad thing to feel relieved that it wasn't your child. It was somebody's child. But they hadn't come to my door. But at 8 o'clock, I watched the 8 o'clock news, and that's when they not only gave that the body count was up to 22, they made a statement that 6 from the striker unit out of Fort Lewis. And so I went upstairs to the computer, and I typed an email to Jonathan, and I said, "My God, 6 strikers. They had to have been your friends. You would have known them. You must be going crazy. I know I am. just tell me that you're okay. And I clicked that send button. And as I clicked that send button, I heard someone at my door. And when I opened the door and I saw that uniformed man standing there, I knew. And he didn't have to say anything. They never have to say anything. As a military family, you know, there's only one reason they send a uniformed officer to your door. And that's to rip your heart out. It's to regretfully inform you that life as you know it is ended. And where do you go from there? The center of my universe was taken from me on December 21st, 2004. People focus on the mothers a lot, but my husband, John's father, is devastated. They were so close. They were like two peas in a pod. But as a man, men are restricted sometimes. Society does that to them. And somehow they're not supposed to acknowledge their grief and their suffering. But he's hurting. It's something that he misses greatly. That friendship. It was so much beyond just father and son. They used to ride together every day. My husband has not saddled his horse since December 21st, 2004. We had a very special relationship. He would always put me first. I say that he was the center of my universe, and he was well aware that he was. I have no doubt in my mind that he knew how important he was to me. And the thing that I miss the most is the fact that he would make me feel that I was the most important thing to him. He loved and respected his father. He always made me feel that he worshipped me. That's something that's very hard to live with. They always say that time heals. I guess it's just not been long enough yet.
How did you hear that he died?
Oh, that's... Eric was working on a school project. He happened to turn on the TV and was watching the news, and then there was a little ticker tape. And... So I immediately called his fiancée to see if she had heard anything. She said no, and I called his dad. And I says, well, it was the 1st Expeditionary Force. So I'm thinking, well, Derek's headquarters battalion, so that can't be him. When you hear that there's an accident, that something's happened, it's like, first thing you think of is it the Army or is it the Marine Corps? If they say Army, they think, oh, you kind of... Thank God it wasn't the Marine Corps. But then you get upset because you think, well, somebody else lost a child. And then, of course, when you hear that it's the Marine Corps, it's like, okay, is that my child? And then you find out that it isn't, and then you kind of feel guilty for being relieved that it's not your child, but you know somebody else lost a child. That was it. I thought, well, that's not Derek. So about an hour later, my ex-husband calls, Ken calls, and Eric answered the phone, and Eric came over and said, Mom, Dad just called, and it sounded really strange. So Eric called back, and probably maybe about an hour after that, there was a loud knock at the front door. I remember it was really hot that day, and I was barefooted. I answered it, and my ex-husband was standing there, two officers, and actually my ex-mother-in-law and ex-sister-in-law. I looked at Ken, I looked at them, I looked at Dorothy and Nan, and I screamed. I felt like I was going to get sick to my stomach. I thought I was going to black out. And then I don't remember what they said. They said, whatever they say. Sorry, I don't know, whatever they said. And finally they said, may we come in? And I didn't want to let him in because I knew if I let him in, that made it real. So they finally, they came in, and I remember I said, I kept saying, what am I supposed to do now? What am I supposed to do now? I ran to my room and put on my running shoes, and I wanted to just run away. I wanted to die. As soon as they told me that, I called up April. I remember she kept saying, what happened? What happened? And I couldn't even tell her because I was just crying. I'm not the only one that's going through this. You know, it's not just on this side. It's on the other side, too. You just don't hear about it. When I ran across a letter, the last letter that I wrote to him, that he never received. And it came back. It was like 6 months later. And I kept it under my desk for a year. And even though I know it is, it's still... it's still hard to grasp. You know, you do everything you can to protect your children. Since he was so active, I always hung on to his little hand as tight as I could because he would just take off running. You know, you do everything for your children to make sure that they're protected, that they're well fed, well clothed, good school. And then the hardest thing for me was knowing that I wasn't there to protect. I wasn't there to help them.
Whatever the meaning is that you attach to it, the death of a loved one, the death of a son, the death of a brother, the death, whatever, is just horrible. And there's no words to be able to make sense of it. And whatever meaning you put on it in your heart is the only way that you can go on with your life living with this. Otherwise, otherwise you can't do it.
It's been 3 years, and it seems like it was just yesterday. And I think it's gonna be like this the rest of my life. And I try to remain positive and be happy. But there's that part that I'll never be the same.
I still can't really wrap my brain around the fact that he's gone. It's like he's going to come home. In fact, sometimes when I'm meditating, I'll say to him, okay, you can come home now, you know, enough. Enough. And I swear sometimes he answers me.
I don't know how it is that I'm expected to continue living every day, but it's something that I have to do, and I have to learn how to live without him.
Is there some lesson we can learn from these three stories and many others like them? Perhaps it is that war should be the last alternative, resorted to only when all other remedies have been exhausted. If the story of these three soldiers can help us learn that lesson, they will not have died in vain.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.